Thank you. All lines are now bridged.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the USCDI Task Force call. We are nearing the finish line here, so I will just do a quick roll call and turn it over to our coach to review our recommendations and transmittals. Carvalho?
Present.
Gary O'Malley?
Here.
Stephen Lane?
Here.
Fred Oliver?
Here.
Carol Turney?
Here.
Carolyn. Les Leonard? Ken Calmodo?
Here.
Clem McDonald?
Is that yes for Clem? That's me, but I'm not sure that's who yes for.
Yes, thank you, Clem. Valerie Gray?
Here.
Tina Esposito? Steve Reedy? And Sasha Termas? Okay, hopefully the others will join, but I'll turn it over to Terry and Christina to get us started.
Sounds good. So, welcome everyone, and thank you, a thousand thank yous to all of you who did ballots, were on calls, sent in emails. It was really, really great. And I think the majority of the task force members got their two cents in one way or another. I think our job today is to go through the probably easiest if we go through the transmittal letter, because the slide deck just mirrors the transmittal letter with less information. And before we start on that, does anyone have any general comments, questions, concerns?
Yeah, this is Clem. I do. So I just looked up the U.S. Post Office format. And it's not an electronic format. It's saying at least 10 points type. One space between city and address. A simple type font. It's always put the address and the postage on the same side of your mail piece. I think it's wrong for this purpose. It goes on. It's just for a paper format. You can find it on the web.
Find it on the web. Yeah, and actually the post office won't really let you use it for anything else. But
it's not a fitting for an electronic structure. It doesn't deal, and there's one that already does that, and it's HL7, both in FHIR and in V2. It's all structured in a standard way. So this is really a distraction and a confusion, I think.
And so, Clem, what would you...
Well, I'd take it out. I think the current situation is just fine. This thing doesn't talk. It just talks about how you put it on an envelope. No reverse type, white printing on a background. This doesn't apply to an electronic content.
Clem, what was the HL7 FHIR V2? Can you point that to us? Does it have a standard that we should be referencing instead?
Whoops, I don't think you have to insist on it because it's already there. It's done the same way in both. You know, there's a name, first name, last. I don't know how it goes. And they deal with the international stuff. First name and last name is not always the same in different languages. And, you know, prefix and suffix and title. And it's got all those things. And I mean, that's the name. And they got the addresses, street address and this. I don't know the whole details. It's what's mostly used. So if we're going to get a different one, it should be at least an electronic one that deals with positions in sort of field positions. This is talking how you print it on an envelope.
Clem, this is Al Taylor from ONC. I had just a comment. I think, and maybe we're just not framing it right or phrasing it right, but when at least when I think about the U.S. Postal Service standardized addressing, it usually is a service that's provided to for when you're doing data entry into an electronic format where it then calls out to normalize or standardize the U.S. addresses. And I don't know what
that's called,
but that's what I think that's what most people think of when they think of U.S. Postal Service sort of standardized.
Okay, what they call it on the web is that, you know, this is called the format and it's got all this other sort of surface things. I think that would be good, but even that's a little, I mean, so my address is Chapel Crossing, C-R-O-S-S-I-N-G, and the post office will turn into X-I-N-G, which is fine, but I'm not sure if everybody knows that, you know, when they write it or when they record it at a hospital. I think what we should do is encourage all systems to convert it into the post office address, street address specifications that they can pull offline. But this doesn't say that. I mean, I agree with that idea, but you have to talk in terms of who has to do that. Is it the person who's putting in their address, or is it the system that accepts it and then checks it?
Clem, I think what we're saying is accept the format. So a standard, because the purpose behind this was to
Terry, the format, if you're looking on the web, the format is talking about all these paper structured formats. Unless you got a different website, I just looked it up. It's describing how you have to record it on an envelope.
There's a USPS Web Tools Application Programming Interface User's Guide document version 5.3. I'm happy to share the link to this. Obviously, there's multiple specifications available, and I'm sure USPS has a written one as well, but there's also online API guidance. And the only thing with this is, as Steve Posnack previously said, is they don't license it for any use outside of shipping. So,
yeah, and I think the point behind this was really came out of the AHIMA paper on patient matching,
I just sent a link that was referenced in that paper in the chat. It's just going through them.
Well, the paper is on the proposal, but the problem is what you'll find when you say format is not. It's not that general statement, but make sure you have a complete and accurate address because they won't match. I mean, so I'm totally supportive of that. I just think that this becomes regulation. It's saying literally USPS format and content, and if somebody looks it up, it's not what you're meaning.
So how about a line with USPS?
Well, I think what you want to accomplish is that the computer systems that receive it would verify it and convert it into the standard address, but are they allowed to if it's only allowed to be used for shipping?
Yeah, and I don't know, Clem, if we're going a little deeper than we have to.
I'm just looking at the words. You type it in the web, and what you get is this thing for format is the thing that you don't mean.
So we want to change the word format?
Well, I think if you've got a reference to an API that gives it as a structure, that'd be fine. But the API, then I just heard someone say, can't be used by hospitals or other clinical care systems.
I think what we're recommending in the USPS format was the one that was cited in AHIMA, was we're looking for really a standardized way of entering name address, basically. So because when it is not entered in a standardized fashion, data entry errors go up, and patient matching suffers.
Well, I don't think the entry, then Terry, what you're saying, you don't want to enter, I mean, the standardized fashion, you need a computer. You need to know that they call XING instead of crossing. I think the intention is absolutely correct and right, but I don't think it's expressed correctly.
Okay. So how would you like to express it?
Well, who knows the API and what it says? There might be a piece of that you could say. But did I hear correctly that the ideal would be that the post office would let clinical systems, when they register patients, to use their checker? That would be the perfect answer. because then a new human has to do it. The computer will tell them, no, this address is probably this. You must get that. You go to some place and ask your address. Actually, other systems let you use it, so maybe it's not restricted just to shipping. I've seen it happen in other contexts where it corrects my address. Does anybody know? Is anybody real familiar with the API?
The address API documentation says important notice, address information API. The address validation APIs can be used in conjunction with USPS shipping or mailing services only. Failure to comply with these terms and conditions can result in termination of USPS API access without prior notice. So it might be that people are using the APIs and are not in compliance with their terms and conditions and haven't been turned off.
Well, what about we recommend then that there would be a request to the Postal Service to allow healthcare registration systems to use it, and then we get everything right. That would be our recommendation.
All right. So that's a friendly amendment. Rest of the group, you want to weigh in on that? Let me just rephrase, see if I've got this right. So our recommendation 1B, where we say encourage the use of USPS format, would be ONC to convince the post office, ONC to investigate
or request access for healthcare organizations to use that system to get the addresses exactly the same or correct.
Well, I think that one acceptable use of the addresses, the standardized addresses for healthcare organizations, is for shipping. I mean, it's a mail address. So, I mean, that's an appropriate use of it. It's just how it's also used for identification because it's used for identification, but it's also used for shipping. So, I don't understand. That may very well be.
We may just say use the API, that healthcare systems should use the API without asking because they probably could already.
Well, I guess if they're sending letters out.
Yeah. So, why don't we say, that the healthcare organizations use the API and ONC. Smooth the road for it or smooth the pathway if there's any barriers.
What about ONC request access for healthcare organizations to use USPS standardized address for capture in the clinical system?
Is that the API?
Yeah. Well, okay. I didn't write API in there.
Well,
but
if you had API, and then we can cite it then because there's a document.
Yeah, we'll just put another footnote in.
Okay, so I'm sorry to be so disruptive.
No. Again, this, one of the purposes of this call is to get issues like that out on Friday afternoon rather than Monday. So, perfect, Sam. That's great. We're going to vote on this on the call. So Christina's recommendation, is that okay with everyone on the call? Sort of ayes and nays.
I like it.
Are there any nays? We're gonna do fast votes, but all right. The chair recognizes that it passes. Okay, great. All right, what's next? Everything else is perfect. That's great. So, if you want, I can go through. So this transmittal letter came about based on the ballots that I think 6 or 7 of you completed. It came about from a phone call which had 4 people on it. And it came about from a smattering of emails that came in. This is all last week. And in the resulting words in the transmittal letter really reflected recommendations that the changes came about on recommendations that didn't have unanimous support of the task force, and essentially were rewritten back to either a more generic, less specific format. So some of our positions resulted in change. For example, the address phone number stuff was pretty straightforward. There was no real big difference there.
The only question I have on that is that the idea of when someone registers, you've got to then include the addresses for their last 20 years, I think it would be painful, and I'd rather say just accumulate them. You know, that is, don't require people to go backwards and enter them. They won't even have systems to do that right now. But just ask that they continue to hold them after they've changed them.
Yeah, all we're asking for is that they include both current and previous addresses. We're not asking them to
enter them,
all of them. Yeah. So, again, we have a disclaimer in the front. I don't know if anyone read the disclaimer, but basically says we're just talking about data elements. We're not talking about how someone's got to implement it or what the workflow looks like or any of that stuff. We're just...
You just want a place to put it.
You want a place to keep it. Yeah, here's what you need to keep. You figure it out. We don't care.
Well, there's a difference. There you gave them sort of a guidance actions. If you said, here's a place you could put it, versus this is what you must do, there are two different senses.
Yeah, well, this is a must. The USPS format is really a must do. It's to standardize the format, and I appreciate the improved words there, verbiage, but that is a must. That's sort of the basis for error reduction and improved patient matching. So that ranks high up on important things to do, in my mind. Phone numbers. So mobile and landlines, just say, how do we have a place for both of them? We didn't say one should be a priority over the other. It just should have room for both. Recommendation 2B was really to designate whether a phone number is shared or private, which I think captures the spirit behind the recommendation.
Okay, so this is really two things. One is whether it is that of the patient or another party, and the other is whether it is shared or private.
Right.
Okay, that's fine.
Somebody else had a comment on that too?
Yeah, I'm just not sure what the shared or private aren't all. I don't know how you define. I don't know what that is. I mean, because you
mean a home, a landline is shared, right? A mobile line that's designated to an individual person is private.
Well, I thought we're already distinguished landlines from mobile lines, or those.
We were combining two, so this also addressed. If a phone number was a parent that was associated with a child.
Yeah, that's good. But I think that's here too, isn't it? It says, who's it associated with?
Well, the problem is for a child, it may not be in their name, or it may be the parent's cell phone to be contacted in lieu of.
So I know that in our organization, we have a very manual sort of free text process wherein we specify that it's okay to leave a private message on a given phone number. So whether a phone number is a mobile or a landline, it may or may not be private.
Oh, that's So maybe well, we that, rephrase
I,
that.
I think that's a better phrasing. Is it could you leave a private message on it? That's a better phrasing.
Yeah, good point.
But you're right. For any number, it should say, is it mobile or landline? What individual is it assigned to? Now, a home number to a home with six people living in it, you know, that's going to be a shared line. It still may be attributed to the patient themselves, even though they're an adolescent, because it is indeed their home number. But it would be designated as shared and or, you know, not okay for leaving private messages. I mean, however we want to designate that.
And Stephen, would you ask the patient whether this is a number that they would...
Yeah, that's a patient designation, absolutely.
Okay, so what if we rewrite this section to say we're going to do landline and mobile. It almost doesn't matter. Well, but you want to know who it's associated with?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And then whether or not it can accept the private message.
I like that.
And again, the patient has to designate whether it can accept the private message or whether they want to use the line for a private message.
So this is Cheryl. I don't want to throw a wrench into this, but what about the web lines? You know, they're becoming a lot more popular as well, and they're not neither landlines nor mobile.
A good point.
You mean IP telephones?
Yeah, VoIP.
I think I think you'd think of that as a landline, not anything different. It's ringing
well,
in
then
your,
you
in
just might want to use a different descriptor because it's essentially people might not think of it as a landline.
Mobile or other?
Okay. Well, you could say home phone or something like that.
Yeah.
Because it's often the same number and you just get a cheaper service.
Yeah. All right. Or you want to do three designations, landline, mobile, or other.
No. I think instead of saying landline, say home phone. Well, maybe that won't work. But what do you, just because that's kind of, yeah. I don't think there's a difference between the IP lines and the what we used to call landlines. It's just what you happen to buy. It functions the same.
And thinking about why we're asking about a mobile number is because that's useful in patient matching. So it's a good number to know.
Yeah, correct.
Well, though it's interesting, you know, as Clem says, I mean, people now are subscribing to a web-based number that you can access from your mobile phone. You could access it from home, from work. That it's kind of it's independent of the hardware. So, I mean, it is mobile in that sense, but it's not what we traditionally think of as a mobile number.
Yeah, that's what I was talking about.
Yeah.
Interesting.
I've got a Google, my wife, you know, she's got a Google phone number, you know, that she uses for her business.
So we got to get a good name for that, I guess.
Well, we're trying to accomplish at least two things with this section. One is to identify the mobile number just for patient matching purposes. And then we have a communications issue about privacy. And so, you know, maybe we ask those separately. You know, so we identify the mobile number plus any other numbers. And then we ask whether which number the patient would prefer to use for a private message. If any.
I feel like we've gone back and forth on this before. And Terry helped me remember, but I think one of Sasha's statements was, you know, they collect in the systems all of the phone numbers, but putting us like distinguishing between them might be more complicated. So I'm trying to remember, but maybe we could do something like an in-between where we include the mobile and landlines like we have, and then put software should support multiple phone numbers, specifically identifying mobile numbers. Because I think that key is that mobile has come up as extremely valuable for patient matching. So if we say support multiple phone numbers and we don't qualify what they are, but put like if it's a mobile number associated with the patient, put a little star next to it or some other field. So that's the key one that we need.
Mm-hmm. Okay, do we have
I'll take silence. Is everybody liking that?
You want to write the recommendation and read it back? So A is
probably... So I have a, 2A. I'm writing it in real time as we're doing this. So I have 2A, include destinations for both mobile and landlines, period. Software should support multiple phone numbers, specifically identify mobile number.
Okay. And then for B?
still ironing that one out.
Okay. Maybe we'll come back to it. All right, well, while you're working on that, Christina, we'll go down to recommendation 3. So this is simplified a little bit to just focus on collecting email addresses first time around. And V2 can look into more detailed ways to contact the individual. So really, just sort of scoped it down a little bit. So let's get email addresses to start. It won't be everything that everyone uses, but it's easier than specifying everything that could be used. Is that okay with people?
Yep.
Yes.
Okay. Or maybe I'm going to ask it a different way. If that's not okay with somebody, speak up. That way you don't have to answer. Okay. And 4 was consent to authority, individual with authority to consent. That was pretty much unchanged. The last four digits of the Social Security number, there are a couple of comments in our ballot about security concerns. And so this was sort of... We split the difference. This said, you know, include it. We're aware of the security concerns, the privacy concerns.
The security concerns. There's four. The last four digits are. There's 300,000 people with each last four digits on average, because if the early digits are more identifiable, but the last one just churned. Is there a definite? Maybe there is one, but did he give specifics when they complained?
No, but you know, when you read about Google being able to tell who you are based on, you know, 10 pieces of data, you know, knowing you within 300,000 people makes it really easy. Because then if I had anything else, where you lived, your town, it's probably only, you know, 300 people with the same last four.
Yeah.
So, you know, I think in, you know, 20 years ago, that might not have been a problem, but I think.
Yeah. Okay. I get it. Yeah. Never mind.
And then then we said optional, you know, to make space for government-issued IDs, driver's license, in particular driver's license and passport.
Good idea.
Right, so
as long as special long is optional, yeah.
Yeah. And then self-reported gender identity. That was pretty unanimous. Okay. So, Christina, you let us know when you've rewritten the phone number. So in the provenance data elements, this was so the discussion was around how hard it is to tell who the author is depending on the data type. And we sort of flipped it around and said, what if we say just use author for notes and prescriptions, and if the patient is the author? Because those are three unambiguous situations. It's going to be an author for each of those that we can identify. And for everybody else, for any other data class, any other data elements, so we are satisfied with the author's organization, but we don't have to know the author.
So for notes, are you including textual notes like radiology reports?
Yeah, I think so.
Textual results, I should say.
Yeah, I think we're talking about clinical notes. So you can.
Yeah, but I would include text. I would include textual results.
Okay.
So
we made it broadly to clinical notes in general. That may not be the right thing to do.
I mean, but it seems to me ambiguous as to whether you consider a path report or a radiology report or the interpretation of a sleep study to be a clinical note. And each of those clearly has an author.
Yeah, those, I would consider them a clinical note.
So I'm, and that's fine. I just wouldn't immediately. So I would just say, including textual results.
Okay, so we want to add that piece in? Okay.
I would, personally.
Well, you know, I'd suggest, though, we add something. There is a big activity around this in the standards organization. They're actually, the Internet Engineering Task Force has defined a whole spec for provenance, and I think we should say this should be adjusted according to, with consultation with the appropriate standards groups. Because I don't know that we can write a spec that well.
Okay.
I think it's good what we've done, but I just would worry that.
Yeah, but okay. Well, we're not writing specs. We're saying what belongs in USCDI.
Well,
you know, for any data class or element in USCDI, someone has to be responsible for the spec.
Well, but you're specifying how it has. There are some very details you're putting in here that may collide with things. You may not need them because they're somewhere else in the message. I just think I just think we shouldn't overreach and just say that, you know, adjust as needed in accordance with the evolution of the standards.
Yeah,
I'm not criticizing what we've done, but I just worry that I don't know enough for sure about how it's going to evolve.
Well, but again, I think the standard speaks more to where it is in the message, and we're at a higher level than that. We're sort of saying that for USCDI, it should include these data. You know, we started, ONC shot across the bow that it should include the author, and we're sort of saying, well, it doesn't really need the author in all situations. It only needs it in certain situations where it's unambiguous.
Well, I'm happy with it written. I'm still not confident in the long term that we're not going to collide. And what's the harm of suggesting that it should be, you know, that should be adjusted as appropriate for the, what's the thing? Because some of this has worked out already, and we haven't studied it.
Yeah. And Clem, I think you know, we'll give ONC the benefit of the doubt that that's exactly what they're going to do. You know, they're going to take our recommendations because we don't get to write them. we get to offer them. And,
all right.
And ONC will say, you know, this is a great idea, but A, there are no standards, so, you know, we'll see you later, or yes,
yeah.
There are conflicted standards, or
okay,
we'd like this one.
They're on the phone, right? With
yeah,
us.
Yeah. Yeah,
do you understand that you, this is
yeah,
not
here.
A dictation? Yeah, this is something you would take with, you'd adjust as needed?
I think that, this is Adam Wong, I think you can... you know, assume that ONC will do the proper research and due diligence
right.
To make sure that
right.
You know we do it properly.
Thank you. You won't blindly follow our command.
Yes, right. Fortunately, no. Follow us over this cliff. I don't think so. All right. So how far did we get? So we got. So the author is designated for every other. All other data classes, we're going to include text blobs that have an author. Okay. And then the other change was instead of author's timestamp or author's organization's timestamp, I think it was Sasha who just said, why don't you just call it timestamp? Because timestamp is really a local issue. We're asking a local system to place a timestamp on data and be able to use it for the provenance of that data element. And how they do it is really up to them. We were afraid we were trying to get too much into the weeds and be too specific about how that should be done.
I like that. I think that's a good suggestion.
Yeah, it simplified things in my mind. I said, oh, duh, yeah, that's true.
Well, I mean, for the record, if they're using any of the standard standards for sent messages, a time span is very, very specifically defined, but it's allowed to be longer or shorter. Because some of them, you can actually define the Greenwich Mean Time in this timestamp.
Okay. You know, and that's fine, because all we want the timestamp for is to have the generating organization be able to tell us. And whenever they say it was born is when it was born, rather than when the author released it or, you know, whatever it was we proposed earlier. And then the last, then there's an addition, which, again, sort of clarified on recommendation 12. Go back to 12. And that was, remember we had said, you know, consider creating a unique patient identity. And so instead of that, the substitution is the system should indicate when the patient is the author of the data. So we're not trying to create a universal system of patient identity. We're just saying your system should tell. Be able to tell when it is the patient.
I think we'd like that, but we can't ask for it.
Of course we can. Yeah, we can say we need to know when the patient is the author. And
I'm agreeing with that. I was talking about the idea that it might be asking for a unique identifier, which I wish we had, but we can't get.
Yeah, and you know, yeah. And then we go down those weeds. And I think, you know, I think the second a universal patient identity is or identifier is available, it'll be here, you know. But it's going to be an act of Congress, I think. Okay. We're okay? Any nays in the whatever section
no,
we were in?
No nays.
No nays. Great. Okay. So now we're into clinical notes, and this is where I think it was Sasha primarily who made some recommendations about eliminating some notes. So we just said the list that ONC proposed, those eight note types, We set definitely back 5 of them. And recommendation 14 is change imaging narrative to diagnostic imaging report, which is about to be released because it and should cover everything that the imaging narrative would contain.
So Terry, I mean, I like everything it shows here, but I wasn't crystal clear. Those things that say take back, people are agreeing with that. Is that's not something that's I agree with them, but I just didn't know whether each of them was a separate decision that we should agonize over.
Well, and hopefully we're all in agreement about consultation, discharge, history, procedure, progress.
Well, it's a succeeding recommendation. I just want to know, are there mixed opinions on recommendation 14 through 24, or can we consider them as a block?
Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry. Christina?
No, I was just going to say we, per recommendations from ONC, we put them individual, so it would be easier to reference them.
I meant in terms of our positions in this discussion, are these mostly sort of vetted and we can just say we like them all, or do we need to discuss each of them?
I guess the question would be if anyone has any different opinion, then we ought to just see these as a block because they're basically saying don't add these note types because there's another note that already is available that covers it.
Yeah. I like all of them. I think it's somebody did some good thinking.
Yeah, well, it wasn't the co-chairs, so that's good. All right, good. So, and then the next one is we said, okay, include all the following things. And there are really 3 that we said you ought to include: the continuity of care document, the operative note, and the miscellaneous note. Miscellaneous just being a placeholder for stuff we don't know where to put anywhere else. So
I think
any,
they're all good. All good.
Okay. Yeah. Any nays on those? So then we pulled out. Good. All right. So then we pulled out. There's a bunch of other recommendations: the transfer of care, advanced directive, and the care plan note. And we proposed that they be made optional this year. Really to get, our toe in the door. And it also gives a pretty strong heads up of what's coming.
Another, also good ideas.
All right, we're all speak up when you don't like it. And then we push referral note and long-term services supports notes to a future version. And
I like it.
Okay, we're all okay. Well, that was the hard part. The pediatric vital signs came through unscathed, I believe. We just basically said on the calculated versions that we adopt all of ONCs. Before we said, no, we don't want BMI, we don't want to wait for age. We said no. But then we said, but you can use them in certain circumstances. So we really accepted them. So we accepted all of ONC's recommendations with the caveat that if you don't store it, then you don't have to send it unless you give it to the patient, in which case you have to have a copy, even if it's a PDF of a nomogram or a note or something. Doesn't have to be discrete data. So, because there were 2 concerns. One was how hard it is to calculate it, to send it if you don't calculate and store it. And the other was if you do give it to the patient, then the next clinician down the line needs to have that information too. So you've got to store that and have it available. So that was sort of the thinking behind those. And it's the same for 25 and 26.
I like how it came down.
We're all going once, twice. And then, and Stephen, we amended the ONC description of the item weight for length. So we changed weight for age per length to weight for length percentile by age and the sex.
Yes, I saw that. Thank you.
That captured your okay, good. All right. On to 27. Unanimous. Occipitofrontal circumference passed without dissent. Okay. So then we get to, so are there elements that we ought to propose in other data classes that we were not asked to comment on that are important? And there are really only three.
Could I back up to 27 for a second?
Yeah.
Because I thought the head circumference was already embedded in a HIPAA and being done already by rule.
I don't think so.
I thought it's one of the vital signs.
Well, if it's there, it'll be easy.
It was this is Al. It was an optional vital sign for CCDS.
So we're just saying we should make it required? Is that what we're saying? Or was it optional because it can only be done in kids?
It's only used in kids, yeah.
Just a clarification. So it has been in some spec already. Is that what you just said? So then I think what we're saying is we'd make it required, because otherwise we're being redundant, or we're saying something to do that's been done.
Yeah, my read on it, yeah, it is not proposed to be optional like it was proposed to be optional, well, like it was implemented to be optional in CCDS.
Okay, so we should highlight that this is the same proposal. I mean, we're saying to strengthen what has already been done to make it required. I mean, what it looks like, we didn't know about the past, and I don't think that looks good.
Well, ONC proposed that this be a required element within the USCDI. So the recommendation here would be that the task force agrees with ONC to make it required rather than
optional
previously.
Yeah, I was just looking for some clarification of that this isn't brand new, and I agree with what you're proposing. I'm not disagreeing, but just make it clear that this wasn't green field. We're going to make what was optional, we're making it required, so that vendors don't have to scratch their heads. They just have to throw a switch and say it's required rather than scrape around and figure out something new to say. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. So do you want to just add something as a required element?
Yeah, say the current...
I think this is implied. So I think that anything that is kind of being proposed in B1 or USCDI by ONC that we are looking at, it's implied that it's already required somewhere and has been already kind of made it up to that optional status at some point, at least, if it's not already required.
Well, I was just saying is that the currently required or optional occipital frontal circumference for children under 3 is going to be made required. I think that's what we're really saying, not to start from scratch. Or am I missing something? I may be missing something.
Yeah, just that if the ONC is proposing it.
As required.
Yeah.
Oh, so we're disagreeing.
We're just saying go for it.
Okay. Never mind.
Unlike some of the other times when we didn't.
Yeah.
All right. So going on down to 28, care team member data class. You just said, why don't you throw in some demographics so you know who's on the care team? And we'll leave it to ONC to figure out what the identifier is, because we couldn't. And for medications 29, what we did is we took out the reconciled med list and who reconciled it, because it's clear that that's an important process, but it's not a uniform one and it's not done well across the board. So we left that out just because of the lack of clarity, but left in the indication of associated diagnosis with each medication.
You know, with the CMS requirement to include any medication data they have and deliver it to patients and providers, and I heard at the last HL7 meeting that some of the non-CMS controlled ones are thinking they'll do the same thing. We might finally have a unified sort of record of all the prescriptions, which would make it easy to do the reconciliation. We're not there yet, but just wanted to put that in your mind.
That's great. And you know, and it's going to take that, because it's such a difficult process, and the places that do it well spend a lot of time doing it. It's not easy. So that would be wonderful. That's great. So any nays with demographics for care team members, so we know who they are?
Love it.
Okay. And then 29 is the meds. Okay. And then the last is, so we moved the homelessness designation out of address to recommendation 29. And so, no, I'm sorry, 30. My apologies. So there's some way to designate when someone is homeless or displaced or a refugee. Yeah, and the use case that comes to mind most recently are the wildfires in California, where there were thousands of displaced persons who had to have their medical care managed.
Yeah, it's interesting that displaced, refugee, and homeless all have very different connotations.
Yeah,
I don't know if at the level of USCDI they're all the same or if they're different.
Yeah, good point. I think the commonality of it, it's almost, these are people, it's really hard to know where they are or where they're from or where they're based, and yet we have to manage their care. So do we need a heads up that tells us that this is the case? That's what this designation would do. It'd be something as simple as just saying they don't have a fixed address.
Yeah, so I mean, maybe it's just a simple designation that they don't have a fixed address. Though in the case of the displaced, you know, I think you mentioned the fires. I mean, people may have an address that's still their legal address, but they aren't using it currently, or it's not available, or it's been flooded or burned or blown off or something. I just don't know if we just want to get a simple, you know, yes, no, this person doesn't have a fixed address, or if we want to ask for more than that. Maybe keep it simple for now. It's like the designation in the family history screens that says adopted. You know, it's like it's just one little piece of data, but it tells you a lot.
So, Stephen, you're saying amend this to a designation for individuals without a current fixed address?
Yeah, I think that's fair.
Something like that?
Yeah.
And then we'll get rid of the homelessness, displaced, and refugees, which sort of money.
Well, no, I think those are okay. I think it's okay. I frankly think the way you've got it written is pretty good. You maybe just need to get an EG.
Okay, EG.
For patients without a fixed address, EG, those experiencing homelessness, displaced or refugees.
Yeah, that's a good point. It helps clarify.
Right.
Now, I had, you know, the reason I threw in that language about address entry standards is because this is something that we have struggled with, you know, in the current state where we don't have this designation, where we said, well, if we don't have a way to say that they're homeless, let's at least all agree how we're going to enter homelessness in the standard address fields so that we can understand that when we share information across organizations. So maybe if you have the designation as a discrete field, you don't need the address entry standards. But that's where I was coming from when I suggested those words.
Yeah, I think the address entry standards, if I'm remembering correctly, was that it needed to be somehow married to the other address standards. Yeah, so.
Right. What do you put in the street, city, state, zip when someone is homeless?
Right. You know, you might, right. A null value. Can you accept a null value in your address
here? Yeah, so I think that's still worth including here.
So in the descriptions, what would you add?
Well, maybe just, you know, the idea that a standard specification of what should be put into discrete address fields for people with this designation.
Okay, so we're recommending to ONC to do something. So we want them to include a designation,
a specification of how address should be entered for people with the designation of no fixed address. Because what happens is that the systems are trying to do patient matching on address, and they can't do it because different organizations have come up with different ways to fill out the fields for homeless folks.
Okay. So include a specification, is that what you said? Hope somebody's writing this down.
Here. There. I wrote it in the chat.
Wonderful. Okay. All right. And any nays, concerns, allergic reactions?
That looks good, Christina. Thank you.
Yeah. Right. Okay. And then we said we have a missing data class. Because we didn't know where else to put this. So this is 31. And that was a quality measures data class. Recognizing, so we took out all the stuff we had in before about how one might do it and what the process might be, to just say start a process to build this data class. Recognizing it's not going to be easy. There are a lot of quality measures. They're not harmonized. But if we don't start somewhere, it's going to stay the same. So any thoughts on that? We're okay?
Yep, okay.
No qualms, concerns? Okay. Okay, great. And then the last one was, instead of assigning a unique identifier, to begin the process to assign a unique and persistent identity for each data element with its governance structure. And this is So what we're essentially doing, and Al agreed we can do this, we're just punting this whole problem to ONC and just say, this is a real problem and we need to solve it. Have at it. Without any guidance.
So why did we give up on all of the thoughtful ideas that we've come up with? Because, you know, I mean, this came up in ISPTF. We worked on it further here, and now we're just sort of throwing that all away?
No, I think it's just to do the first step. You want to add more. I mean, we can add more to the paragraph. I took most of the verbiage out just because
it's a messy space, Steve, and it isn't, and the pathways aren't settled. You know, the CQL is just kind of now available or almost available, and how that'll work and how it'll change things. And there's a lot of kind of changes going on now and what they want to do in quality measures, so.
And the quality data reporting architecture, quality reporting data architecture, the Quadra, which CMS is pushing. So I think there's going to be a lot that a data class like this could help support. And I think I see this in the long run as being just another way to get a group to come forward to be the stewards for a data set or data elements that get into.
Well, I guess the one thing, Terry, that you stripped out that I'd recommend we maybe reintroduce, not so much all the detail about, well, you need one for the first one and one for each, you know, instance, et cetera, but just kind of the use cases that we identified, you know, the importance of being able to deduplicate and version. Maybe if we could at least grab that sentence and keep it in.
Sure. Right. Okay. Got it.
So it was deduplication and what was that, Stephen?
Well, we worked it pretty hard before. I'd go back to the earlier version. I mean, it was deduplicating and versioning were the two that come to my mind. I don't remember if we had a third one that we'd come up with.
I don't remember this conversation. Those were
the two, I think.
So did we make it through all of them, Terry?
We made it through all of them.
Okay, so in the chat, and I'm sorry, it came through weird with the spaces. I copied and pasted what I captured for the patient demographics. I might have missed part of it, so I want to make sure we got that right.
Okay, so Christina, great. Are we feeling okay for Monday? We'll make sure that the slide deck syncs up with the changes we've made to the transmittal letter. And we'll flag the changes that we made today in the presentation, just to give a heads up to the high tech. Okay, folks, so great piece of work. Next week, on the 17th, Steve Posnack is going to come by and give us an overview of phase two, which is going to be the sort of the advancement process for how data elements go from being proposed to being in USCDI. And we took a stab at that a year ago, and you know, came up with six steps, which Clem thought was like four too many. And ONC agreed that it was at least three too many. So they've kind of got it down to three steps now. Okay. But anyway, it's the way it is. But they absorbed most of what we said. They just telescoped it a little bit. But, you know, not to steal Steve's thunder, but I think the important part was that it's a wide open process to nominate data elements, that it'll become part of a publicly maintained data set where you can see it and see what's happening to it. And then that goes through the steps of sort of clarity, harmonization, and then standards, attaching it to standards, or encouraging standards to be attached to it, until finally it gets tested and into production, and then finally into USCDI. So,
I'm excited to hear where they want to go and how our task force is going to be able to help support that.
Yeah.
You know, the other thing, the other real open question, which comes up a lot, is not only kind of what's the process for introducing new ones, but what are we going to do with that proposal that came out over a year ago now of, you know, what was supposed to be added in 2019 and 2020 and 2021 and beyond? Is that going to be dusted off, and actually is that work going to begin at some point, or is that all just being thrown out as a lot of interesting ideas and we're going to start from scratch? You know, is that part of what Steve is prepared to talk about?
I don't know, but that's a good question. We can ask him.
I didn't know if maybe you guys had a pre-meeting already.
No, we saw the slide deck, but we didn't kind of delve into any real detail. But those are all
you know,
points.
Yeah, because when you're out there talking to people, you know, everyone's enthusiastic about USCDI, especially as it's been named in the NPRMs, et cetera. You know, but everyone immediately asks, so, you know, what about that glide path? You know, not just the process, but the actual contents as they've been proposed. And so let's be sure that Steve knows we want to talk about that too.
Yeah. You know, and what strikes me is how many potential high-value data classes and sets, data element sets there are, and how limited appears to be the bandwidth to get them incorporated and tested into vendor systems. And it's just a huge mismatch. And so the prioritization is going to become really important, and I'm not sure we have a mechanism for prioritizing.
But Terry, so some of the constraint or the bottleneck is that many of those require manual entry and would fall on physicians who are resisting it.
Yeah, well, that's...
Maybe appropriately.
No, and you're right. So that's sort of a third dimension, right? So it's one, this is valuable for somebody. This is the pain that the vendors are going to have getting it into their electronic systems. And this is the workflow agony that's going to result from adding this. So you're right. So there are three constraints, three gates on this process.
Well, the last scan, unless we figure out some easier way to capture this stuff, I think it's going to be almost absolute, because at least in primary care, there's not any time left, and people are fleeing it because of this non-patient care activity, how they consider it. I think it's a very strong barrier. But it doesn't mean that we can't, you know, like, automatically understand videos or something and figure it out. Or get some of that stuff in a different way.
Try a whole new data class, right? I mean, going to include
AI.
It'll be an interesting phase two. And Steve will tell us what our timelines are going to be, too. I suspect it's going to be pretty tight, fall being the target date, if I recall. So anyway, we've now booked out in Lauren or Adam or Stacy, have we sent out the calendar invites for Friday afternoon through the near future?
I believe so.
Okay.
We can confirm, if not after. I'll follow up with Sal.
So just because I suspect it's going to be a pretty tight timeline. But we'll know more in a week.
Mm-hmm.
So any parting shots before we open it up for public comment? On the journey
I just
to
like
London?
I'd just like to compliment the chefs.
All right. Well, there were many chefs that made this almost edible. So it's this is an amazing group that had to work really hard to get this done. So, you know, we're trying as much as we can to follow your lead. Unless there are any more, and thank you, Clem. Any more comments, questions, concerns? Train is leaving for Monday. Okay, Lauren, open them up.
All righty. Operator, can we open the line?
If you would like to make a public comment, please press star 1 on your telephone keypad. A confirmation tone will indicate your line is in the queue. You may press star 2 if you would like to remove your comment from the queue. For participants using speaker equipment, it may be necessary to pick up your handset before pressing the star key.
Thank you. And any comments in the queue?
There are no comments at this time.
Okay, if there's nothing else, Terry and Christina, if there's nothing else, we can adjourn.
Yeah, no more housekeeping stuff.
Thank you all.
Not from my end, but good luck on Monday.
Great. Okay. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you all.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, everyone. Bye.